my pleasure to bring back into the mix here Paul Thompson from the Center for Cooperative Research and author of The Terror Timeline. Welcome back, Paul.
Hey, thanks.
So let's start to actually dive into some of the content of the book here. And we, as you mentioned before we got on the air, an hour is not even adequate to probably get through the first 100 pages to any level of detail. So we're going to bounce around a bit, give people a flavor of some of the stuff that maybe they haven't heard about before regarding 9/11, even if they've been listening to KABU for the past 3 years. Because as someone who's looked at this topic quite a bit, I feel, there's a whole lot of stuff in here that I just went, wow, hadn't heard about that. And one of the things that I had heard about but didn't know full level of detail is something called the Atlanta Rules. Now, many people probably remember that the Summer Olympics took place in Atlanta, Georgia in 1996 between July 6 and August 11, several weeks. Air attacks, attacks via airplanes, were a major concern at those Olympic Games. And so during the Games, Black Hawk helicopters and U.S. Customs Service jets are available to intercept suspicious aircraft over the Olympic venues. Counterterrorism official, I don't like this word czar in the context of U.S. government people. I don't understand that. Counterterrorism official Richard Clark uses this same security blanket approach via preventing air attacks to other major events, referring to the approach as the Atlanta Rules. Now, the Atlanta Rules didn't only apply to the U.S. Olympics. In fact, and in an ironic way, they were used on the day that George W. Bush was installed as president. Something I find very curious. Now, they claim repeatedly that they could have never known that there was any sort of realistic threat based upon an air attack. And had they known, they would have, I believe George W. Bush said, moved mountains or moved heaven and earth to try and prevent them. Tell us a little bit about what's ridiculous about their story on these lines.
Well, I'm really glad you talk about the Atlanta Rules, because as you're right, not a lot of people know about them. And there was an interesting anecdote that came out in the 9/11 Commission final report that I unfortunately didn't get to put in the book. But in 1999, Richard Clark led an exercise, according to the 9/11 Commission, that it wargamed the idea of a plane taking off from Atlanta, Georgia, and getting hijacked and crashing into a building in Washington, D.C. And this exercise was done with the Secret Service and NORAD, the, you know, the fighter response people, the FAA, and then he was heading it. And in the wake of that exercise, they were very concerned that they would be unable to protect Washington, D.C. From that type of attack. So they wanted to permanently install the Atlanta Rules over Washington, you know, not just for special events. They used it for a number of events, but have it there permanently. And the Secret Service pushed that pretty hard, apparently. So did Richard Clark. And it never happened. And it's, you know, seems like such an obvious thing to do, but it never happened. So that's a lot of thing, a whole thread of information that most people don't know about.
Now, something that a lot of people probably do know about is the fact that several governments, foreign governments, at least a dozen, and I don't know the exact number, gave warnings with varying degrees of specificity regarding the 9/11 attacks. I believe the French and Egyptian intelligence services gave some of the most detailed information. And after 9/11 took place, the Bush administration continued to deny that they could have known anything about any of what happened on the 11th of September. But as it turns out, in fact, they had reasonable amounts of information that should have pointed at least to take some sort of preventative, basic preventative measures. Say the August 6, 2001 memo, where the title was "Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the United States." Mm-hmm. Kind of a basic sort of clue. Now, you have in the timeline, May 16, 2002, Dick Cheney says that Cheney states people in Congress need to be very cautious not to seek political advantage by making incendiary suggestions that the White House had advance information that could have prevented the tragic attacks of 9/11. Breaking from the quote, well, they did.
And they then, certainly did. And yeah. I'm glad you mentioned also the foreign warnings, because...
Well, let me just finish this quote, because sure. it relates to what you're about to say, I'm sure. Cheney continues that criticism of the official story is thoroughly irresponsible in a time of war, and that any serious probe of 9/11 foreknowledge would be tantamount to giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Now, what were you saying?
Yeah, it's pretty incredible, isn't it? How are we going to stop the next terror attack if and when it happens if we don't know what happened with the last one? And the problem is, all this is so buried under the name of national security that it's hard to really figure out what's going on. And so if you have everything buried and unexplored, then all the problems, you know, the people responsible are all still going to be there. And we're going to be, you know, we're going to be hit again and again. So I just can't believe that people will say things like that. But in any case, getting back to the foreign intelligence warnings, you're right. There are about a dozen of them. And I found a piece of information I put in the book that really puts it all together for me about why we got all these warnings. It says in the, according to the 9/11 Commission report, they said that, in the summer of 2001, Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan actually started publicly talking about the 9/11 plot in front of large crowds in mosques and training camps. Hmm. He said things like, let's say a prayer to the 20 martyrs on their mission. And he said other things like, there will be an attack in the U.S. soon and thousands will die. So if you look at some of these foreign governments, they had moles in Afghanistan or moles elsewhere in the world in the Al-Qaeda operation. But you didn't even need that, because the 9/11 Commission report goes on to say that these public pronouncements spread throughout the entire fundamentalist Muslim world. And so you had people throughout the entire world aware of this upcoming plot. There were, as I have in another chapter, there's all kinds of people in the U.S. who had advanced warning of the plot. Like, for, you know, one example was some Village Voice reporter got into a cab one day in July 2001, and the cab driver, who was from Egypt, said, "I'm getting out of the country before beginning of September when the big terror attack happens, because it won't be safe here." You know, she went and reported that to the FBI, and the FBI found out that, in fact, that is what the person was claiming at the time, and that he, in fact, did leave the country when he said he would. So how on earth could the U.S. not know, when it seemed like literally everybody and their brother who had anything to do with this was in the know?
Well, and theoretically, not only the U.S., but other intelligence agencies infiltrated al-Qaeda. So theoretically, there's intelligence agents, if not directly connected to the U.S., sympathetic to the U.S., who would have passed information along, and we know that this did happen, saying that here's what they're talking about in, you know, their private secret meetings.
Yeah, like the Egyptian government, they gave a warning. They had very good intelligence,
several,
apparently based on some mole, where they told the CIA there are 20 people in the U.S. on a mission. Four of them are training on light aircraft in the United States, but to the Egyptians' government's surprise, the CIA wasn't apparently even interested and didn't ask for any more information along these lines. This is according to 60 Minutes on CBS. I mean, this is all this stuff has been coming out in very big publications, and yet it didn't make the front pages. It didn't get the attention that it deserved. And then the 9/11 Commission, they didn't put a single one of any of these foreign government warnings in their report.
Really? Not one?
Yeah, not a single one.
Okay. Well, and then there's the whole issue of the insider trading scandal, which, to the extent that it's mentioned at all, is only mentioned in passing with no detail. And the thing that surprises me, or maybe not surprise, but the thing that just stuns me is, A, not only how little of the American public is interested in actually finding out what happened, it seems, and have just decided that, you know, the official story is what happened, because there's really not a whole lot in the way of documentable evidence to say, yeah, in fact, the government's story is what happened. But how many people in positions of power, whether it's, and not even inside the government, like I'm looking at early September 2001, Securities and Exchange Commission announces they're investigating trading of 38 different companies in the days prior to 9/11. You know, so this means that folks at the SEC aren't all that concerned about this, the New York Stock Exchange as well. And the U.S. is not the only country where insider trading took place. There's apparently, I'm assuming, still ongoing investigations in Germany regarding
this.
But
actually about a dozen countries launched investigations on this in the wake of 9/11. The only one to ever come back with any results was Britain. After a few weeks, they said there's nothing there. All the rest, including the U.S., have never published any formal conclusions. Some journalists have tried to figure out what's been going on with all these investigations, and they said, you know, it's just utter secrecy. You can't even begin to figure out what's happening because nobody's talking. And yet, when those investigations started, you had things like the head of the Bundesbank saying, in Germany, saying, if I don't remember the exact quote, but something like, if this is a coincidence, it's one of the greatest coincidences in history. And, you know, other people saying that this almost incontrovertible evidence of insider trading. And yet the 9/11 Commission kind of dismisses the whole thing in a footnote. I don't think they even began to get to the bottom of insider trading. I really think that I try to be impartial, but I think there's no way to get around the fact they're a whitewash. And
well, and there's still all that unclaimed money, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, millions.
You just scratch the surface a little bit, and the conclusions of the 9/11 Commission don't even begin to stand up. Like, one example would be just in the news yesterday. The 9/11 Commission claimed that essentially the bin Laden family and Osama bin Laden broke in 1994, and that they've been separated completely ever since, that he never got a dime from them afterwards. And just yesterday, one of bin Laden's brothers was testifying in Europe in a court case and said that they were continuing to share bank accounts with Osama bin Laden years after 1994 and continuing to get money, you know, distributing money to him from the family account. So, you know, this claim that they came out with, it, you know, that the family was cut off financially from him in 1994, that only lasted, what, about a month and a half since the report came out? I mean, you know, I think that so many of the things that they claim are just going to fall by the wayside one by one as we look at them closely and as more information comes out.
Well, let's use the conversation with bin Laden bank accounts to segue to talking about money issues related to this here community radio station.